Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. Controversy is not subsiding with the first edition of the North American Free Trade Agreement now available. In fact, far from it. The debate is growing more heated as participants look at specific text. We'll have the story. Also this time, you may be throwing away good money along with your kitchen and yard waste. And all aboard the Earth Train, bound from Los Angeles to Washington, the trainload of young people is on a mission, says Kristen Braun.
And we borrowed a theme from the group City Kids, which is one of our youth partners. It's each one, reach one, each one, teach one, each one, bring one into the sun.
Some of the stories this time on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. A first edition of the North American Free Trade Agreement has been published and circulated to key organizations, including members of Congress and select environmental organizations. Weighing in at a hefty 1,000 pages and more, NAFTA represents years of work and the potential start of a new era in North America, opening up trade regulations to encourage the free exchange of raw materials and finished products. The treaty now faces a lengthy review and ratification vote in the U.S. Congress and similar scrutiny in Mexico and Canada. Testifying recently before the Senate Finance Committee, Environmental Protection Agency Chief William Riley said the agreement is a solid and positive step toward environmental protection in all three nations. Sierra Club Director of International Programs Lawrence Williams disagrees.
Sierra Club does not feel the NAFTA is currently drafted is suitable. Either needs to go back for redrafting, renegotiation, or for the negotiation of auxiliary treaties which would go to Congress in conjunction with the NAFTA.
And what would be some of your specific points of objection?
Sierra Club has three primary points of concern. One, we do not want Mexico to become a pollution haven for U.S. companies. We feel that U.S. companies moving to Mexico should be obliged to comply with U.S. environmental standards, and that U.S. citizens should have the right to ensure in U.S. federal court that they do meet those standards. We do not wish this treaty to be a mechanism in which Mexico can challenge our high environmental standards as barriers to trade and, for instance, call upon the U.S. to again allow DDT because Mexico uses DDT on its food products. And thirdly, we wish that the cleanup of the U.S.-Mexican border be directly tied to NAFTA so that we can put in place, using the Free Trade Act, a mechanism which will ensure that the financial and human resources will go into actually cleaning up that cesspool.
Williams says there is nothing in the current text that would address these three concerns, which is why he believes the document needs to be renegotiated.
There is nothing in the law that ties the cleanup of the U.S.-Mexican border to NAFTA. The administration has resisted that all along. We have told them for over a year now that that had to be done. They have said absolutely not, we will not hear of it. So that if that is to happen, if we're going to find a mechanism that actually takes care of that enormous environmental problem, it's going to have to go back and go be renegotiated, or an auxiliary companion treaty negotiated to deal with that. There is also nothing to prevent pollution flight to Mexico by U.S. industry. We are still unsure how the NAFTA will affect Mexico's ability to challenge our environmental laws. The language says that this is not acceptable, but we're not sure that it has any binding effect on Mexico.
These objections are not supported entirely by other environmental organizations. Rodrigo Prudencio, a trade specialist with the National Wildlife Federation, says we ought not to be concerned that Mexico and Canada often have lower legal standards for their environmental laws. What should concern us more, he says, are differences in the approach to enforcement of those standards. A law on the books is effective only insofar as it is enforced. Unlike the Sierra Club, the National Wildlife Federation would work with the existing NAFTA to insert more compelling language at certain points. Citing a typical example, Prudencio says the mechanism for dispute resolution needs to be amended.
Where a country holds a higher standard and another country with a lower standard wanting to import a product brings a dispute in front of a in front of the Trade Commission, which will oversee these disputes. It's possible that public participation could be a could contribute to that process of dispute resolution. In other words, in hearing citizens or non-governmental organization testimony. Except the NAFTA does not spell this out as a requirement, only as an afterthought. And we'd like to see it explicitly named in the process, not as it states right now. It doesn't oblige a country to do one thing or another. And we'd like public participation to be explicitly named as part of this process of dispute resolution.
Prudencio is encouraging the formation of a North American Commission on Environment, as has been proposed. This commission would oversee the participating nations and issue an annual report on how each is enforcing its own environmental laws. For example, it would be publicly disclosed once a year just how the United States is dealing with its hazardous waste problem. And we would have a similar document detailing how Mexico is enforcing its clean water standards. For example, whatever comes of the NAFTA, or the wider GATT, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, or the European Maastricht Treaty, there should develop stronger and stronger ties between the trade community and the environmental community, says Prudencio.
In other words, we shouldn't always be asking for protection of a species or limiting trade in something or another because it has certain trade implications. Well, what we're saying to the trade community is you have to stand up and recognize that what you do as a trade community, the policies that you set, have to begin to acknowledge the environmental costs of those activities.
Rodrigo Prudencio, a trade specialist with the National Wildlife Federation. Lawrence Williams, director of international programs with the Sierra Club, says if the changes he recommends are in fact accomplished, then the agreement will be a bold step forward to global environmental protection.
It would be a positive recognition of how environmental quality is directly tied to trade and how trade agreements can be a very positive force in ensuring the protection of the environment, and we would be very pleased to see something like that happen.
The collected works of the North American Free Trade Agreement have only recently been received on Capitol Hill and to other interested parties. It will be weeks, if not months, before the material is absorbed, understood, debated, amended, and either ratified or rejected. With trade and the environment a hot issue anymore, you can be sure to hear more about NAFTA right here. This is Bruce Robertson. The nation's nuclear plants have created 20,000 metric tons of highly radioactive spent fuel rods. Currently, this waste is stored at nuclear reactors. But utilities that own the plants want the government to find permanent storage. In response, Congress created a nuclear waste merchant to find areas that might accept the waste. Jill Hoyt has this profile.
Abraham Lincoln memorabilia and souvenirs from various political campaigns decorate the Boise office of the nation's first nuclear waste negotiator. David Leroy, a gracious and friendly man, points to an unusual collage hanging on the wall behind his desk.
Literally a piece of the Berlin Wall, but I like the sentiment, and it was even the most formidable barrier is only a temporary setback to those who are determined to succeed. Not an inappropriate reference to our work.
Many say Leroy's task is as daunting as the Berlin Wall once was, but Leroy doesn't seem daunted. He's smiling and upbeat as he goes about searching for a home for the thousands of spent fuel rods produced by the nation's 112 nuclear power plants. Leroy's designed a plan based on volunteerism. He's asked the nation's 623 jurisdictions, such as Indian reservations, townships, and counties, if they'd accept $100,000 just to study the possibility of allowing a dump in their area. If they agree, he'll promise them just about anything.
We can work schools, we can work roads, we can work anything and everything that they want to work, because our ability to consider and design benefit packages is that broad.
So far, no area has expressed interest in becoming the nation's first permanent nuclear waste dump. Politicians from a few remote western areas agreed to consider a temporary site, but their constituencies were so enraged when they heard about it that many tried to either recall their leaders or stop the process.
Good evening and welcome to Man, Energy, and the Environment. I'm Hodding Carter, and tonight our subject is nuclear waste and the West. It's a tough, contentious subject. Facts abound and collide, and so do passions.
A debate and call-in show based in Boise, Idaho, aired recently on PBS. Representatives from government, utilities, anti-nuclear groups, and the public searched for solutions to the waste problem. Dan Reichert of the Natural Resources Defense Council said Leroy's plan to find more temporary storage sites is a big mistake.
Basically, what you end up doing is taking the waste off the hands of the utilities, thereby reducing the impetus and interest they have in finding a permanent solution, and you simply transfer the problem to another location. And I think there's no way to guarantee to the people in that new location that that waste is ever going to be moved again.
The General Accounting Office, the investigative arm of Congress, says waste can be safely stored at nuclear power plants for a century. But Congress, following strong lobbying efforts from utility companies, told the U.S. Energy Department to take ownership of the spent fuel by 1998. Spent fuel rods remain dangerously radioactive for 10,000 years. Still, David Leroy remains boyishly optimistic about his task, despite pundits calling him a pariah with a lonely job.
Instead, it's been my challenge to try to design a process by which people could say maybe and consider these facilities so that we can have an intelligent dialogue in this country about whether or not states or tribes, in their own interest, can help solve a national problem. That's an exciting job, and in fact, I think it makes this the best job in America.
It's at least a job that needs to be addressed. By the year 2030, when existing nuclear power plants have run their course, we'll have four times as much spent fuel as we have now. I'm Jill Hoyt in Boise, Idaho.
Jill Hoyt reports for the High Plains News Service, a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils in Billings, Montana. According to 1990 figures from the Environmental Protection Agency, 45 million tons of food scraps and yard waste are generated each year in the United States. Though more and more of us are turning to backyard composting for this material, most of it ends up going to landfills, left to rot in plastic garbage bags. As landfills reach their capacity, however, cities are turning to a natural alternative, municipal solid waste composting. It will be soon used in 19 American cities. Worldwide, there are more than 500 such facilities in operation. University of Washington professor Dr. Charles Henry, one of several scientists studying compost made from municipal garbage, says the process is similar to our backyard operation.
Just basically, if you look at a waste material, like what you do in your household or something like that, and you look at that and you say, okay, well, what would compost nicely in my backyard? And you take out the things that won't, and that's the same sort of thing that is done on a big scale. It's done by machinery and so forth, and there's a number of separation procedures, including hand picking, including magnets to take out ferrous material, eddy current machine to take out aluminum cans and things like that. So it's done on a larger scale rather than on your home scale.
Composting works when organic materials decompose or rot. Eventually, organic materials can break down into mulch or a wet mixture that can be used as fertilizer. But whether you are a homeowner or a municipality, your first step is to separate materials like glass, metals, and plastics that will not decompose. According to Henry, many of these materials are separated by weight or are too big to pass through a screen in the processing plants. But he says any mixed solid waste compost, even when it is separated by machine, contains some contaminants. And that is the basis of his work right now. With scientists at the University of Iowa, Ohio State, and North Carolina State, Henry is working to set safety guidelines for municipal compost.
One of the needs was to have standards for what acceptable compost is. And a big gap was simply the research that provides a technical basis to come up with those standards. So over the last couple of years, those needs have been identified, and there have been some contracts made with different universities to study the different levels of contaminants that are acceptable. Anyhow, we are studying the effects of these contaminants on both plants and the soils, and eventually how it affects the environment and human health.
Henry and his colleagues are studying plants grown in the compost to see if they will absorb metals like lead or chemicals like PCBs from the soil. According to Jackie Prince, a scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund, that research points to the main problem with municipal composting. She argues the best way to prevent soil contamination is to separate the contaminants at the curbside.
Our feeling is that it's very important to focus on inputs as well as the product standards, which are dictating the quality of the output. It's like any basic system that you look at. If you ignore what you're putting into the production system, you can't expect to have a high-quality product. And our feeling is that you need to control your inputs. You need to look at how to set up collection and separation systems so that what you are composting is the organic, clean material that makes sense to compost.
Prince cites lead levels as one of the biggest concerns. She says data from European composting plants show high lead levels in municipal compost. Prince says it may be caused by lead glass or crystal mixed into the garbage. But Dr. Henry argues it does not matter if mixed compost has more contaminants than pure organic compost, as long as it meets the safety standard.
There are a lot of people who suggest that a mixed waste compost is not as good as a source-separated compost because it may have higher contaminant levels. And it may have higher contaminant levels, but just the fact that it may be a slight amount higher, even a little bit higher, both the composts are still or can be very acceptable compared to what the safe standard is. And I have yet to find people show me the documentation on why a mixed waste is not acceptable because of the contaminant levels when they really don't provide that what that safe limit is.
At this point, there is no safety limit for compost, but Henry expects it will be separated into two classifications: compost that is safe for all uses, including agriculture, and compost containing more contaminants and thus limited to landscaping, for example. The push for classifications comes mainly from the Solid Waste Compost Council, a group of environmental organizations and companies led by Procter & Gamble, supporting municipal waste composting. But Prince of the Environmental Defense Fund predicts the classifications will become obsolete as curbside recycling increases. And she cites another reason for her prediction of obsolescence. Many mixed solid waste composting plants in Europe are closing down in favor of curbside separated compost. Dr. Charles Henry is a researcher at the University of Washington in Seattle. Jackie Prince is a scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund in Washington, D.C. And this is Bruce Robertson.
I'm riding on that new river train. I'm riding on that new river train. It's that same old train that brought me here. Soon gonna carry me again.
Kristen Braun and 100 other young people are on the right track. Heading out of Los Angeles recently, Kristen and her friends will be traveling across the nation aboard the Earth Train. We reached her in the early morning hours on the day of the departure. Kristen, you are a 17-year-old freshman now entering UCLA. You just graduated from high school. Why do you feel so strongly about environmental issues to be a part of this project?
Well, the reason I feel so strongly about it is that I think that there's no greater issue that can bring people together or that needs to bring people together for me, because, like you said, I've only been around for 17 years, and I hope to have a long life ahead of me. And there's some real issues out there that could be concerns and could get in the way of my long life. And so I really have always had a passion for taking care of people, and taking care of people means taking care of the planet.
The Earth Train project has been many years in the planning, says organizer Nathan Gray. Gray is chairman of the Gateway Pacific Foundation and will be traveling with the students. Gray joins us now on the line. Mr. Gray, how would you describe the mission of Earth Train?
Well, Earth Train is a 10-year campaign by youth to youth with a call to action, where the young people involved with Earth Train, the youth leaders, are reaching out to their peers, other teenagers, and saying, get involved in community service for the environment, and also take the time to get the skills you need to be effective in organizing new organizations, getting community service initiatives started in your communities, and perhaps even nationally. So the Train and Earth Training includes youth-to-youth training, teenagers training teenagers.
Kristen Braun says she is hopeful that Earth Train will reach many other young people with the right message and that action will be taken.
I really do feel optimistic because, there's nothing stronger in terms of teaching than teaching from your peers. And that's what the whole foundation of our program is. And I think, people learn best from each other that are, equals. And so since it's youth-to-youth training, it's not someone who, you're not be able to relate to. So the people that we're going to be able to train in the cities that we put on these conferences, I think really will be touched and really will be impacted. And the great thing about Earth Train is that it's a multiplier. It's that, and we borrowed a theme from the group City Kids, which is one of our youth partners. It's each one reach one, each one teach one, each one bring one into the sun. And that's our whole idea, is that we're bringing some really important information to people, and I think that it really will be valuable. And I think that young people just need to know that they're cared about and people think they're important. I get so frustrated when I read headlines that say I'm not important and that the education I'm receiving is the worst in the world and that, I have no future and that everyone around me is pregnant and dealing drugs. And I think that it's time to stop that negative stereotype and to really invest in our youth. And I think that's exactly what we're doing. And I really do think that people will be responsive.
The logistics of the journey have the students boarding the train, an old steam locomotive with 14 vintage cars, in Los Angeles, heading north to San Francisco, and then east to Denver, with stops later in Chicago and New York City before arriving in Washington, D.C. At each stop, the students will hold rallies and organize conferences for young people in each city, says Gray.
The core of Earth Train is not the dissemination of information, it's the dissemination of leaders. And what we're excited about is that we're building a group of very talented organizers of conferences, organizers of teams, who will be working with us in subsequent Earth Train events.
Nathan Gray is organizer of Earth Train. Gray is also chairman of the Gateway Pacific Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving international cooperation. Kristen Braun is an entering freshman at UCLA. At 17, she is, you might say, an elder youth on the journey. Gray says Earth Train will be training students from 16 other nations so that similar projects may get underway. The whole project expected to last 10 years, with Earth Train Japan scheduled for 1993, followed by Europe in 1994, India 1995. In each of those years, there will continue to be an Earth Train rolling across America, with the trip next year slated to travel from Mexico through the United States to Canada, to address issues affecting indigenous peoples from Central America to Northern Canada. There will also be an Earth Train arriving in Atlanta for the Summer Olympics in 1996. This is Bruce Robertson.
Daddy, what's a train? Is it something I can ride? Does it carry lots of grown-up folks and little kids inside? Is it bigger than our house? Well, how can I explain when my little boy asked me, Daddy, what's a train?
Well, that's our report on the Environment Show this week. We hope you enjoyed the program. If you'd like a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Be sure to ask for The Environment Show, program number 143. Our thanks to Karen Kelly for the report on the Solid Waste Municipal Composting Project. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.